This is the sixth study in our series on apologetics, the defense of the Christian faith. And this study is entitled Evolution and Time. The primary point of this lesson is that there is no evidence to support the theory of human evolution, nor is there proof that eons have passed in the Earth's history. We have begun this study of apologetics by surveying the area of science and its relationship to Scripture, because we saw at the very beginning that God has revealed himself in four different ways. God has revealed himself in creation and in conscience, which are called natural revelation. And God has revealed himself in the area of history and in the Scriptures, which are called special revelation. There is much that is taught today in the realm of science that seems to contradict the biblical revelation that God himself is the one who has created the world, and therefore that the creation itself tells us something about God, the fact that he is, the fact that he is eternal, the fact that he is sovereignly powerful over all that he has created. Now, that which is taught in this area against God is not truly scientific. It is merely the theories of men. And so we have begun this study by showing that the scientific evidence that is truly scientific does not contradict the message of Scripture that God is the Creator, so that when we are dealing with people who have been brainwashed or in whose minds serious questions have been raised about the role of God in creation, we can give them at least some evidence from science that the theories of science that contradict Scripture are in fact merely theories, not actual evidence. We have seen, for instance, that it is impossible to say scientifically that God does not exist, because the evidence of science, that is, the evidence that has been discovered in the realm of physics and thermodynamics and in the realm of astronomy, indicates that there must have been a God who existed at one time to bring the world into being, to provide the energy that the world is now using in the process of existence. We turned our attention to the origin of life, and we found that it is not scientific to say that life could have originated by chance, apart from the personal touch of an organizing, creating God. Then we turned our attention to the area of the evolutionary theory. If life had originated by chance, how in the world was it supposed to have progressed from simple to complex? And we have seen that the theories of evolution do not support the evidence that in fact there is no theory that can actually explain how life could have become as complex as it is today by natural processes. Now, before we get into our subject for today, the subjects of prehistoric man and the geological timetable, let's look at the quiz that you have taken to see how well you are doing in your reading. Remember to read the chapter and take the quiz before the class period so that you can mark your quiz during the class period. Right, the first five questions were from Whitcomb's book, The Early Earth. Number one, true or false, God is still in the process of physical creation. According to Whitcomb, that is false. Page 21. That which was created completely at the time of creation, and God is presently in the state of sustaining creation. But even the first law of thermodynamics, or the first law of the physical creation, is that we are not still in the process of creating. Number two, creation was sudden. That's true. Page 24, God spoke, and it came into being. And there is no way to explain a slow, gradual process of original creation. Number three, there could be no genuine creation of any kind without an initial appearance of age inherent in it. That's true, page 30. By that, Mr. Whitcomb means that if anything was created immediately and it was complete, then it's going to look as if it's been around for a while, because we don't know how anything would look that was originally created. If Adam and Eve were originally created immediately, they had the appearance of age. Maybe they looked to be 30 years old. Maybe they looked to be 15 years old. But they certainly didn't look to be simply embryonic, or they didn't appear to be like babies. They appeared to be older than in fact they were, because they had been created complete. Number four, actual age is not the same as appearance of age geologically. And that's true, page 33. What scientists sometimes interpret to be extremely ancient geological layers are interpreted on the basis of the appearance of age, and that may not correspond to their actual age. It all depends on the theory that one approaches with to determine what it is that causes the appearance of age. If you deny the original creation, then everything has to be very, very old, because in some way you have to explain how it could all have come about by natural processes apart from a creator, and it would clearly have taken much, much longer than it actually took if God himself did it instantly. Number five, the miracles of Jesus Christ are evidence of supernatural creation. The answer to that is true, page 38. The same power that was resident in God when he created the world was resident in Jesus Christ. And so that power that he used to do miracles is an evidence that God himself was the creator. Now to Francis Schaeffer, The God Who Is There, pages 63 through 69. Number six, man's despair today is partly the result of being made in the image of God. That's true, found on page 63. It's not that being created in the image of God in itself causes despair, but the despair is the result of this division within man. Since he is created in the image of God and has the concept of morality and has hope, as Scripture says, God has put eternity in his heart. He sees what he wants to be, what he could be, and yet in contrast to that, he has fallen. And it's this conflict between being fallen and yet wanting to be whole, like God, that creates despair. Number seven, as the 20th century mentality would understand religion, the Bible is a non-religious book. That's true, page 65. But the reason for that is that 20th century mentality does not understand religion as something that's based in history, but rather it is simply a subjective experience. And the Bible is an historical book. It is more than history, but it is at least history. The religion of the Scriptures is grounded in real events that have taken place in time. Number eight, in all forms of the new mysticism, there is a growing acceptance of polytheism. That's false, page 66. Schaeffer says there is a growing acceptance of pantheism. Polytheism is the worship of many gods, but those gods are personal. Pantheism is the identity of everything that is with God. And God then is impersonal. Number nine, review question. The name of Darwin is associated with the evolutionary theory of embryonic recapitulation. as false. Darwin is associated with the theory of evolution by natural selection. Number 10, mutation and natural selection can account for most evolutionary progress. That's false. The theory is that it must, but we saw last time that there is insufficient time or genetic material for mutation and natural selection to account for the life forms that exist today. Now let's turn our attention to the area of time and evolution. The first subject that we want to look at is the area of prehistoric men. We have said that creation tells us about God, that that which exists is evidence of a creator. The Bible tells us that God created man supernaturally, that God created Adam and Eve uniquely to be what they were. But the claims of Scripture have been called into question by an area of study called anthropology, and some anthropologists claim to have discovered ape men, that is, links between the animal kingdom and the human kingdom, or in fact they would say that man is simply another of the forms of animal, and that he is genetically related to the animals. And there is supposed to be a trail of evolution from the ape family to the Homo sapiens. And we mentioned in our last discussion of the kind of chart that one might find in Time Life series on prehistoric men that appears to give a clear trail of evolution from the lowly ape to the modern man. Now, so far we have discussed chance and time in the general theory of evolution and have found that the theory rests upon fancy, not upon fact. The general theory of evolution says that all life was created by chance, has progressed from simple to complex over millions or billions of years. Now we're turning ourselves to evidence of progression. Is there evidence for progression from simple to complex? And we want to center especially on the area of animal to human evolution. We're asking ourselves, were there really links, were there really ape men between apes and humans? The point of this discussion is that the discoveries of prehistoric men have yet to turn up an ape man. A prehistoric man is simply a man that lived before written history. An ape man would be a character that was part human and part ape. A clearly related individual to both the human and ape families. There have been several different instances of the discoveries of individuals that have been claimed to be ape men, part ape, part man, or at least something that was on the trail of evolution between ape and man. And I want to discuss a few of these. There are several that have been clearly discounted by every anthropologist and would not even appear in any chart or any serious study on the trail of evolution. But let me discuss a few that are still popularly thought of today as being ape men. The first one that I'd like to refer to is the Zinjanthropus man. The remains of the Zinjanthropus man have been on display in the Smithsonian Institution in the United States. He was discovered by Dr. L.S.B. Leakey, and was dated to be 1,750,000 years old. That dating was supposedly by potassium argon, but it is interesting that certain mammal bones from the same place that were dated about 2 million years by carbon-14 dated only to be 10,100 years old. So there's a tremendous discrepancy in the dates that could be given to the different bones in the situation that was discovered. The interesting thing about Zinjanthropus is that it had a brain size of 530 cc's. Now, a normal ape brain is about 600 cc's, and a normal human brain would average around 1,200 cc's. So we ask ourselves the question, did the brain of Zinjanthropus resemble more the brain of an ape or the brain of a human? And the answer is, it resembled more the brain of an ape. What about the skull? Well, the skull originally consisted of about 400 fragments, which took about a year or a year and a half to put together. When they were put together, as they were put together, they had a cranial crest, a little wave, a little extrusion on the upper part of the skull that is typical of all apes. So the skull looks like an ape, and it has the brain the size of an ape, and there is really no reason to believe that it was anything other than an ape. To pretend that the Zinjanthropus was something between ape and man is to make an assumption for which there is no evidence. Now, in fact, Zinjanthropus is now classified as an Australopithecine, and I'd like to discuss just a moment the Australopithecine, or in the singular, the Australopithecus. The original of these was found by a gentleman named Dr. Dart, and at first it was dated to be something like a million years old. But carbon-14 dating of mammal bones from exactly the same place as the Australopithecus dated only 15,500 years. The Australopithecus was found with tools that either it used or which were used on it. And one of the most complete of the original Australopithecine was an individual skeleton called the Tongs baby, T-A-U-N-G-S, which had a brain size of 494 cc's at 6 years of age. And then one can extrapolate to an adult and can estimate that its full size would have been about 550 cc's. Again, we ask ourselves the question, was that more like an ape or more like a man? And the answer is that it's more like an ape. G. Ashley Montague from Johns Hopkins University says that the Australopithecine could not have been directly ancestral to man. And Leakey said that the Australopithecine are an example of over-specialization not leading to man. Now, isn't that interesting that the Zinjanthropus, Leakey's own discovery, is classified as Australopithecine, and Leakey himself says that the Australopithecine are not part of an evolutionary chain, and yet Zinjanthropus and other Australopithecine are often pictured as a link in the trail of evolution from the ape to the human. As you know yourself, a dead end doesn't lead anywhere. And if the Australopithecine are dead ends, then they should certainly not be pictured in any proposed trail of evolution. A third individual, or a third category of so-called ape men, are the Sinanthropus, otherwise called the Peking Man. The Peking Man were found by Hugo Black and then taken over by Dr. Weidenreich. They were originally dated to be approximately 550,000 years of age. And Weidenreich estimates that the skull of the Peking men were somewhere from 850 to 1300 cc's. And sometimes students will see pictures of the Peking men today with skulls that are something intermediate between the skull of a normal human being in the skull of an ape or a monkey. But anthropologists have pointed out that these large skulls are models only. They do not represent the original discoveries of the so-called Peking men. O'Connell says that the prototypes have never been photographed, that they were not described by other anthropologists, and that they appear to be simply the inventions of Mr. Weidenreich. All of these Peking men, the ones that were supposedly intermediate between the human and the ape, were found with a hole drilled in the skull, apparently where the brain had been extracted, and they were found in what appeared to be a garbage pit in a cave. In the same cave were found three undamaged skulls that were obviously human. And it is interesting that when the workers found these human skulls, skeletons, in exactly the same cave, that the original discoverer of the Peking men either died or committed suicide the same night in the middle of the finds. And subsequently, all of the so-called Peking men discoveries just disappeared. None of the original finds are left. And yet there were three anthropologists, Boulay, Teilhard de Chardin, and Bruil, who had drawn copies of the original ones. And all of the original ones show brain capacities of less than 700 cc's. And the evidence is then that what is often called the Peking men in books today were not really the original Peking discoveries. But those original discoveries were creatures that were simply ape-like, that lived alongside of human beings, were probably fed upon by human beings, and therefore there is no reason at all to propose that they were a link in the chain of evolution from ape to human being. In fact, some have proposed that they were probably simply a macaque, a monkey. A fourth discovery that is sometimes called an ape man is the Pithecanthropus, or the Java man, classified along with the Sinanthropus as Homo erectus. These were originally discovered by a gentleman named Du Bois, and they were theoretically dated to be around 350,000 years old. Now, there are no complete skulls or skeletons of the Java man, so there are only estimates of what their brains may have been like, and none of those estimates are more than 900 cc's. The original discovery was of a calotte, that is a bone formation that is on the top of the skull. Then there was a femur, a leg bone, that was found 50 feet away. And while the calotte, the skull part, was clearly ape-like, the femur appeared to be the bone of a creature that walked upright. Now, along with that calotte and the femur, there were found also two modern skulls at the same layer, and those two modern skulls were hidden for 28 years by Dr. Du Bois. He did not reveal that the calotte and the femur were found separated by so much space, but he put them together and then theorized that perhaps this was an ape-like creature that walked upright. After 28 years, he revealed that, in fact, there was the distance found between the calotte and the femur, that at the same site these modern skulls had been found. And scientists, having bought his story that he had found an ape man, now had to say, no, it is probably a fraud, and that the so-called ape man was probably nothing more than a gibbon. In fact, Dr. W.R. Thompson in The Origin of the Species says that the Pithecanthropus is not to be classified with a Homo sapiens, and he says it is the evident case of fraud. Now that brings us to the last two categories I would like to talk about, and that is the Neanderthal man and the Cro-Magnon. The Neanderthal man is supposed to have been one of these characters that was sort of alley-oop-like, who walked, stooped over, probably grunted, had a barrel chest and a squash skull with protruding eyebrows, probably pulled his wife by her hair, carried a club, spoke caveman language. Supposedly, Neanderthal died out around 45,000 years ago, and the Cro-Magnon is supposed to be the prototype of the modern man who came into existence from 10 to 50,000 years ago, and is supposed to be in every way as intelligent and upright as we are. In Israel, on Mount Carmel, some years ago, there was found in a cave the remains of an adult male Neanderthal, of an adult female Cro-Magnon with 6 intermediate skeletons, and it appeared to be the burial ground of a family. The intermediate skeletons showed some of the characteristics of Neanderthal and some of the characteristics of the Cro-Magnon, which would mean that there was interbreeding. In fact, Leakey says it seems that some of the Palestine skulls represent the crossing of Neanderthal and of Homo sapien. And if there was crossbreeding and they lived alongside of each other, then one cannot say that Neanderthal is a chain in the link leading to Cro-Magnon. But in fact, modern anthropologists have shown that that original concept of the Neanderthal as being sort of an ape-like creature was really based on the original discovery of an individual that was suffering from a deformity of the skeleton, and that of all of the Neanderthal that have since been discovered, that deformity has not been found, and scientists would now say that the Neanderthal was a creature that walked upright and looked more or less as modern as you and I look. That in fact, Neanderthal was a racial type, not an evolutionary type, and that one cannot put him as a link in the chain between ape and modern man, since he himself lived alongside modern man, interbreeded with modern man, and therefore may as well be called modern man. And what we have seen in this brief survey is that when one looks closely at the discoveries of the so-called ape men, one finds on one end of the scale obviously apes, on the other end of the scale obviously men, and in between nothing but theories, frauds, and projections based on inadequate evidence. There is yet no reason to believe that there is a trail of evolution from ape to man. And of course, if God created man supernaturally and completely, then there will be no evidence. It would seem to me that it would be profitable for Christians to take up sometimes some of these discoveries instead of being scared when we read in the newspaper a journalist's interpretation of modern evidence. We can actually look clearly at the evidence that is available, and we will find, if Scripture is true, that the evidence does not support the evolutionary theory that there has been progress from simple to complex. Now, that will raise a question in many people's minds. Well, what about all of the fossil evidence? We have discovered just a brief, small area of the fossil evidence for the so-called evolution of man. But isn't there mountains of evidence? Aren't there mountains of evidence for evolution? Aren't there geological layers that clearly show the progress from simple to complex? And in answer to that question, I would like for us to discuss in conclusion for a few moments the geological timetable. What does it show? Does it, in fact, prove that evolution has taken place? The answer to that, I believe, is no. The geological layers do not represent either proof of evolution or proof of long periods of Earth history. The geological timetable is really a chart that has been constructed showing the progress of evolution from simple to complex, as supposedly evidenced by the geological layers in which fossil remains are discovered. How has it been constructed? Well, according to the theory of evolution, life progressed from simple to complex. Therefore, in relationship to time, simple fossils must be old and more complex fossils more recent. Now, that means that you can date the rocks by the fossils that are found in them, because if a fossil is very simple, then that means the rock layer in which it is found must be a very old rock layer. And if a fossil is very complex, then the rock layer in which it is found must be more recent. So the geological timetable has been constructed by putting the simpler fossils and their rock layers on the bottom, and the more complex or more recent fossils and their rock layers higher up the scale. So one can go from the very simplest, which would be the oldest, up the scale to the more recent, which would be the youngest. Now that means that you can date the fossils, because if a fossil is found in a very, very old rock layer, then those fossils must be old. And if fossils are found in more recent rock layers, then those fossils must be newer, younger. So you know how old the rock layer is by the simplicity or complexity of the fossils that are found in it, and you know the age of the fossils by knowing how old the rock layer is. Now, maybe that confused you, because what I said was you date the fossils by the rocks, and then you turn around and you date the rocks by the fossils. That reminds me of this story that I heard of a plant foreman in Switzerland who daily walked by a watchmaker's shop on his way to the plant to see what time it was, because it was his duty to blow the noon whistle every day at the plant. So each morning as he walked by the clockmaker's shop, he would set his watch, he would go to work, and every day at noon he would blow the noon whistle for the village, and every day when the noon whistle blew, the clockmaker would run around his shop and set all of his clocks by the noon whistle. That's exactly what a circular argument is. You have two arguments, both of which depend upon the truth of the other. And in the case of the construction of the geological timetable, the theory of evolution is the principle upon which the whole construction is based. If, in fact, life did not evolve from simple to complex, then simplicity does not actually mean age, nor does complexity mean youth. And if life, in fact, did not evolve from simple to complex, then the rock layers cannot be dated by the simplicity or complexity of the fossils which they contain. So it's a circular argument. Dr. H. Walstall has written in the Encyclopedia Britannica that it cannot be denied that from a strictly philosophical point of view, geologists are here arguing in a circle. The succession of organisms has been determined by a study of their remains embedded in the rocks, and the relative ages of the rocks are determined by the remains of the organisms that they contain. It's a circular argument. Dr. Carl Dunbar, professor of historical geology at Yale University, has written, "Inasmuch as life has evolved gradually, changing from age to age, the rocks of each geological age bear distinctive types of fossils unlike those of any other age. Conversely, each kind of fossil is an index or guide fossil to some definite geological time." But you notice that his original sentence was, "Inasmuch as life has evolved gradually." That's the principle. And if that principle is not true, then the rest of the theory that is based on the geological timetable has no basis to be believed either. It is merely a circular argument. So one problem with the apparent evidence of evolution that is derived from the geological timetable is that the very timetable itself is a circular argument. It's based on the theory that evolution is true. Now, the second problem with the geological timetable is that, in fact, fossils are not found in order in the Earth's crust from simple to complex. One writer has said that it is significant that literally any rock system in the entire geologic column may be found lying directly on the basement complex, and that any combination of rock systems may be found above it at any given location. That's from Principles of Sedimentation. Harvard paleontologist George Gaylord Simpson has written, "For the present, the failure of the phyla to appear in the order which would be expected as natural on the basis of increasing complexity is merely stated as a fact." It's a fact that the phyla do not appear in the order in which they should appear were evolution true. As examples of that, the human being is supposed to be relatively recent according to the theory of evolution, whereas the dinosaur is supposed to have died out approximately 120 to 130 million years ago. And yet, human footprints have been found fossilized right alongside of dinosaur footprints. In fact, I personally have slides that were taken in the Paluxy River, the Glen Rose Canyon in Texas, of an apparent human footprint and an apparent dinosaur footprint embedded in rock actually crossing each other. It is impossible that the prints could have been made at different times. And furthermore, there was theoretically no mammal that lived alongside of the dinosaur that would have had the same kind of print. There have also been found fossilized human footprint in coal and oil deposits, or in coal deposits. And there have been found fossilized human footprints in lake beds of trilobites, a creature that was supposed to have died out hundreds of millions of years ago. There have been found cave drawings of dinosaurs. So the actual evidence is that the human and the dinosaur and these other so-called ancient individuals did not live separated by hundreds of millions of years, but lived instead alongside of each other. Now, I know that that's impossible according to the evolutionary theory, and most modern textbooks are based upon the evolutionary theory. But if the evidence is interpreted apart from the theory, then the evidence shows that, in fact, evolution did not take place. We have seen two problems with a geological timetable. One is a philosophical problem. It's based on circular reasoning. Secondly, there is a practical problem, and that is that the fossils do not appear in order in the so-called geological columns on the Earth. A third problem is that fossils are nearly lacking in the oldest layers, which should contain the most examples of primitive life. We know that over 90% of all species that have ever lived are presently extinct. And yet the oldest layers, which should have contained great examples of primitive life, are almost devoid. But on the other hand, those old layers, supposedly old layers, have been found to contain very complex fossils. For instance, geologist Clifford Burdick has found fossilized pollen conifers and flowering plants, even in rocks that have been classified as Precambrian in the Grand Canyon. Not only are there great amounts of fossils lacking, but most important of all, there are still no fossils that show the links from one kind to another kind in the animal family. And that's the greatest problem, because there are lots and lots of fossils that have been discovered. But none of those fossils represent actual evidence of evolution taking place. Now, that's the most significant argument. If evolution did take place, and if it took place over millions of years, and if it took place very, very slowly, then there should be an abundance of fossil evidence that, in fact, there was change from one kind to another. But all of that evidence is still lacking. And so we see that in every area of the general theory of evolution, that all life has originated by chance, increased from simple to complex over millions or billions of years. That is all based on the faith of the evolutionist. It is not based on evidence for what actually did happen. Let me quote one more time from Dr. Kirkut, from his book, The Implications of Evolution. He writes, "It seems to me at times as if many of our modern writers on evolution have had their views by some sort of revelation, and they base their opinion on the evolution of life, from the simplest form to the complex, entirely on the nature of specific and intraspecific evolution." That is, they base their opinion simply on the basis of theoretical evolution, not on the evidence. It's interesting that Kirkut uses the word revelation there. We have said that, in fact, man is dependent upon revelation if he is to truly know anything about God that is absolute and perfect and eternal. And yet those who do not believe in God would say, well, revelation is foolishness. How can you know that it is from God? And what we have shown here is that the person who begins to challenge God in the area of creation is himself basing his faith on his own opinions, not on the basis of evidence. He has faith, more faith than the person who believes in a creating God. But his faith has no evidence to support it. There is nothing wrong with having faith, as long as that faith is based on evidence and not simply based on theory. Does the creation, in fact, show us something about God? Yes, God has revealed himself in creation. Creation tells us that God exists, that the God who exists is greater than the world that he has made, that he existed before it, and that he is able to sustain it. There's no reason to believe that he went out of business at the time that he created. In fact, the God who created also goes on to say that he wants us to know something about him. He gave us evidence that he exists not only in creation, but in other means as well. And with our next class, we will leave the area of science and we will take up another area of God's evidence through what he has done.